I'm sorry. yeah, we will. Welcome to the Academic and Student Affairs Committee today. I was telling Liz, it's my last meeting, and I've never seen an agenda this big. So I don't know if that says something or what's going on.
We just know how capable you are.
Yeah. But we'd like to give a special welcome to Tammy Pfeiffer, who just walked out to probably get a call.
I just got pulled out.
Governor's education person and Representative Owens, we're happy to have you here. You're a great friend of education. We appreciate that. And the rest of you here, glad to see Board of Trustees members. And anyway, let's get going. A lot of these policies we've discussed quite a bit, and hopefully we can be done discussing them after today and just watch them work very well, right? So the reason that we have quite a few of our policies is there was quite a bit of legislation that affected our policies, and because that has to go into effect July 1st and we don't have another meeting till then, that's why we have so many things on our policies. So let's just start right at the top and move on down for our nine policies. And we'll start with the first one. It's our Utah Access Promise Scholarship. Yay, yay, yay. And so Associate Commissioner Spencer Jenkins will lead us on that one.
Thank you, Regent Tyer. I think most of this group hopefully is familiar with this. We do have Representative Owens here. We really appreciate the lifting he did during the session. It was quite a lift. A lot of walking and tackling. And you'll hopefully remember in the January board meeting, the initial proposal for this was provided to the board. There was $2 million appropriated for this coming fiscal year. We've been working closely with the financial aid directors at the institutions in formulating this policy. Happy to talk about some of the details around it, but essentially what it does is we tried to maximize the flexibility for the institutions to use these dollars in a way that hopefully dovetails into their existing program for needs-based types of students. It's a door opener, right, Representative? We hope we'll continue down this road a little bit more, but that's really a summary of the policy. From there, I'd be happy to take any sort of questions or concerns on this particular one, but I think the committee is fairly well-versed in this one.
Yeah, and I just like to say, I think one of the things I liked about it really a lot, because I thought about me is a few years ago, a lot of you know that I did go back to school, and it's nice to know that this one is available for anybody who wants to further their education. I just think that's such a great thing. Luckily, I didn't need a needs-based scholarship to do that, and I'm grateful I didn't, but I think there's people that maybe would take that opportunity when they're old like me and do something like that if there was the funding available. So I really did like that addition, because that isn't the same for all of our scholarship opportunities. I think that's one really good thing about this one. Would anybody else like to bring up, I know we've talked about this one before, is there, go ahead. Oh, Jaquel's cheering.
I just want to echo that, as we look at access and pension and completion, that this is, that wherever you are, there's a place to contribute to Utah economy.
Right.
So,
right.
Thank you.
And I think probably, one of the big deals on this one, at least in my mind, is just letting people become aware. I think that's something that, and maybe somebody can mention what, because a high school counselor, that's all great, but that's not going to help the 30, 40, 50-year-old know that. So what are the plans? Anybody know?
So the plans, talking to the financial aid directors, their preference really was to give them that ability, because in terms of returning adults, especially when they are seeking
if they
out.
Want to contact them to return, they can tell them we
right.
have funding.
When you think of people who are looking at going to college, whether it's those in high school, but especially returning adults, they'll seek out the institutions. They're not going to,
that's
no
true.
Offense to the board, but I don't think they're going to seek out the Regents for those answers. And so the financial aid directors really, I think, are probably the best equipped to get that information. And so it's going to be hopefully structured that way. Obviously, we want to talk about it as a state entity, advocate for it, but when it comes to individuals and getting the awards lined up, it'll be through the institutions.
That's right. Okay, that's a good point. Thank you for that. Makes sense.
But again, a huge thank you. Representative Owens was the one that actually sought us out in November, and so he really started the ball. So.
Yeah, it's always nice to see legislation happen that really is for the right reason. Go ahead. I'd love to have you.
It wouldn't have happened without you guys and
Jaquel, who was up there. But it was nice to work with the board of Regents and have your support. There's nothing more important in the world than our young people. And their leadership is phenomenal. Last week we had a tragedy in this valley. We lost 3 young people in a car accident. You might have seen that in the news. And I was the bishop of 2 16-year-old girls that we had to hold funerals for. But my faith in humanity grew seeing the rallying of support, kind of like this legislation and now making it possible for those who don't have means to access higher education. So, and thank you for all your help and your example to our young people.
So you think there's a chance that the funding might grow then in future years?
I mean, the funding will grow, and also the pullback from the private schools, if that can be reallocated and used there. But I'm happy to further the effort for more funding. I think we needed to get a foot in the door. Went in with the idea of $30 million, got to
ongoing though.
Ongoing, yes, and hope for more. But I think that as this goes forward and we see success stories,
that's the stories are gonna do it. I think.
And it's gonna bless life for generations.
And we can't underestimate what you did. And you stayed strong on that private piece, which we all knew needed to be corrected. That's a huge, like $6 million that normally goes to one school. So 40%, I think, of Regents goes there. So that's significant. $2 million plus.
And we've been working on that as long as I've been a Regent. So I'm leaving on a good note because that's been something. No, it is, though. That's something that we've really...
Representative Owen, though, he stood strong because there was a lot of resistance.
I'm still getting a little hate mail. Okay. I just want to thank Spencer because he talked me off a cliff a few times. And I was maybe too gung-ho, to get this in place. Now, the good part is the heavy lift it was in legislation, it takes that kind of effort again if somebody wants to change it. So we'll go forward from here.
Thank you.
For all your help.
Thank you. If there's no other comments, I'll look for a motion from
me. I move to approve the Promise Access Scholarship as outlined.
R620
as outlined.
I'll second that.
Any comments or questions? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
And if we had pom poms?
Yeah, like I'm so stoked.
So our next one is the adoption of our 621, the Terrell H. Bell Educational Scholarship that we have, it's been around for as long as I remember, years and years and years. And so Jeff, are you going to lead us a little bit on this one?
Yeah, I'm going to take the lead on a lot of the rest of these, but the tree experts are mostly in the room here, and so if questions come up, I hope everybody feels free to just participate. So this is a new program in terms of, we don't have a scholarship under this prior, but we did have a similar program. As you probably know, the T.H. Bell Incentive Loan.
Oh yeah, it was a loan.
It was a loan program. Those of you who aren't familiar with these incentive loan programs, like Perkins Loan, and we have a new loan program that we're just starting. These are for students who are going to be majoring in certain areas or certain programs and receive certain grades, and that we give them loans to pay for their school. And the idea is that if they meet obligations after they graduated, for example, if they're going to teach in Utah for a certain number of years or teach in a certain area, that those loans would be forgiven. But if they don't, then the loans become active and they repay them. The administrative burden on that kind of thing is really, really high, because now the schools have to track whether or not they're meeting those obligations. They have to track the professional career for a number of years, and then determining when or when they not repay, how much they need to repay, what the interest rates, it's just very complex. So we ran legislation this year that changed that program, the T.H. Bell program, from an incentive loan to a scholarship. So it's similar in nature in that it's targeting teachers or students who want to become teachers and that will work here in Utah. But instead of making this a loan program, that we can give them a scholarship up to the cost of tuition fees, and I believe it's books, right, Greg?
Up to tuition fees and books.
Yeah, up to tuition fees and books. With the commitment and intent that they demonstrate that they're going to pursue an education teaching degree of some kind, and that at some point we have check marks where they've been accepted in the program, they're making reasonable progress in that program. That's up to the deans and the financial aid directors to ensure that's happening. But one nice thing about this is that there are some prioritization that the legislation required. And so one of the things that the first priority is to go to students who are in underserved populations, and that would be as determined by the institutions themselves. And then also students who are going to be teaching in, do we call it high demand areas?
The legislation calls them high needs areas,
yep,
where there are more significant teacher shortages.
Yep, so, and also first generation students. And so I was, when I said underserved population, that's actually the next policy. I have like 50 of these going around. So the priority is given to first generation students first. And then second, priority will go to students who are going to be teaching and working in those high needs areas. And then after that, if there's money left over, other students could then qualify. So that was the target that the legislature gave, what they wanted this money to be useful for.
Okay. So even though the students, I mean, there's not a requirement that they do stay in Utah and teach, right? Once they get the scholarship, they got the scholarship.
So they have to express, they have to express their intent that they're going to stay in Utah and teach.
And that's the difference.
And that's
really
the difference. So, you know, the complaint is, well, now they don't have a skin in the game, but at the same time, the incentive is there. They've taken steps to demonstrate that they are going to do that. And if they do take steps that leads us to believe that they're not going to stay or they're not going to teach in these areas, that we have the authority and discretion to take the money and stop the scholarship.
Yeah, but the whole point is, if they don't have this debt from school, they actually can stay and teach in a place that doesn't have very high teacher salaries. You know, it gives them that choice, where some of our graduates and some things, they can't, like, anyway. So one thing about it, they might just stay because they don't have the student debt. So
I think also Representative Snow was being responsive to the deans of education with whom he met, who were looking for ways to incent students to start the programs.
Yeah.
Oftentimes,
yeah,
you know, they wouldn't even begin in a teaching program and explore enough about it to figure out, oh, wait a minute, if I don't have this debt and I, you know, you can see school districts are ramping up salaries now to try to incentivize people to enter the profession. And this combination of things hopefully will make it a much more desirable profession for people to participate in.
And much easier to administer.
You know, one thing that's interesting when they talk about, like, the high needs area, I think that's going to take some work to determine that, because some of our school districts in the Wasatch Front have great need for teachers. I mean, it's not like we're not really talking necessarily rural areas now, because every district is having trouble filling teachers. So that's going to be, I think the high needs area is going to be an interesting determination for the board in consultation with the State Board of Education. So
that's been one of the criterion for the current loan program.
Yeah.
So they have lots of practice
in
developing
that.
Well,
they do, and they do that, but I'm just saying, now, even in some of our big districts in the Wasatch Front are having trouble in some areas to get teachers. So it's just teachers are needed. So anyway, is there any questions about this new scholarship? If not, you can accept a motion to approve. Thanks, Steve. Thanks. Second.
Scholarship is almost good.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yes.
Is there any other comments on the motion or the second? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. All right. We're going to move on to another scholarship program. This is also a good one.
Yeah.
So we'll turn it over to Jeff.
All right. So this is R622 Career and Technical Education Scholarship Program. And this is to provide scholarship assistance to students who are pursuing careers in technical career education in high-demand industries. Like the TH Bell, this is contingent on them expressing their intent and then enrolling in these programs that would lead to them working in these high-demand industries. And we would be determining what those industries are in partnership with the Department of Workforce Services regional offices. So, one of the things, the reason why we have this is because in a previous legislative session, they appropriated money for this type of scholarship, but it went only to the system of technical colleges. bit of career technical education within our system. So this is really to close that gap and to provide the education or the scholarship money for our schools as well. So priority in this one goes to the underserved populations, and that is determined by the institutions themselves. They look at what they consider to be an underserved population and then use that criteria to make a prioritization about who would get the, or qualify for the scholarship. And then every other year, we consult with the Department of Workforce Services, the regional representatives, and the eligible institutions to identify those programs and prepare individuals to work in jobs that have higher employer demand and high median hourly wages or significant industry support. And then they submit those programs to the board, and then you as the board approve those as high need programs, and then we use those to make that determination as to whether or not they qualify for the scholarship.
And this is just for non-credit, right?
And we have a sponsor right here, again. So do you want to say a few words?
Letting us spend your money.
We didn't have it before you came.
But it goes to the right place, and I mean, state tax dollars. So, yeah, I've got to be a sponsor on this and appreciate the work within USU System for technical ed. I have two children that are in that field myself, so the ongoing pursuit. We need there is high demand there, and we need those, we need the students and the assistance. So thank you for your support.
Okay. And so it's for non-credit programs, right?
Right. Yeah. Can I also make a clarification? It's also to the three institutions
right.
that have the technical college role. So it's Salt Lake Community College, Snow College, and USU Eastern.
And Moab. Yeah.
And including Moab, yes.
Go ahead.
Are there some specific programs in these institutions that we that are that fall under or are approved for this scholarship? Or when you talk about career and technical education, there are a lot of topics that can be covered. And is it for some kind of a certification program?
Non-credit certification.
Non-credit certification. And any specific fields?
Yeah, so the institutions will work with the regional Department of Workforce Services representatives and then prepare a list for approval by the board of the regions.
These would be areas of high need, high medium wage.
You know, I'm all for this. We have been broaching this for at least 10 years from the industry. Worked with not Snow College, but with UVU and others when they started the sales program there. A degree in teaching people, or certification for teaching people how to be good salespeople in today's highly technical markets. So that was from our needs and our industry needs. So this, I'm really a big proponent of this one.
That's a good one.
Once you have a high school or an advanced degree, when you want to change your career, go through a certification program.
So I'm guessing that you wanted to make the motion to approve this one.
I absolutely did.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Thanks, Marlon. Any more discussion on this R622? All in favor for the approval, say aye.
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 Thank you. All right. Let's go into R165 concurrent enrollment, which had quite a bit of discussion, I think. Go ahead, Jeff.
Okay, thank you. So R165, these changes are primarily driven by two different sets of legislation that came through this last session. In the red line, you see a lot of changes. Many of those aren't related to the statutory language, but are simply to give clarity to the language itself. So they're just minor language improvements. So I'm just going to direct you to the areas that are of most importance and are direct consequences of legislation. So the first has to do with which students qualify for concurrent enrollment, participate in concurrent enrollment. Prior to this legislation, the concurrent enrollment was limited to grades 11 and 12 and 9 and 10 only by exception. The legislation that was passed this year opens it up to all grade 9, 10, 11, 12, so there are no exceptions. It's just if you're in the grade 9, 10, 11, or 12, you are eligible that criteria to participate in concurrent enrollment. There may be other criteria that that are required, if it's prerequisites or things like that, that could impact whether or not a student in ninth grade can take a course. But there cannot be criteria to say if you're in ninth or tenth grade, you cannot take this course. And that was specific to the legislation. Not without its controversy, but we had to update our policies to reflect that change. So that's one of the first things.
So can high schools, do they have any right to, like, I mean, it says about the ACT and stuff, but because it's statute, then high schools have to allow, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're hoping that the counselors and teachers are engaged in dialogue with students and parents about the appropriateness of the course itself. One of the things we've talked about is ensuring that we're very clear up front that students who are taking these courses understand that it is college credit, and that once you earn that grade is there in your record. And so if you take a course that's going to be challenging for a ninth grader and it ends up being a disaster, that disaster will be part of their college transcript. And so that's another way that they can have influence on that decision. They all have to have on file a completed plan for college and career readiness, the students do. That's generally done either with a school counselor or a school teacher. Hopefully that gives them an opportunity to look at their pathway, what CE could do for them, and also then at that point give an opportunity to say that may not be the right course for you as a ninth or tenth grader. But in terms of when we're developing criteria for determining who is eligible, who is not, that is one where now we're not able to restrict them.
Okay.
So that was the first change. The next changes primarily from legislation address the criteria of who qualifies as a CE instructor. And the intent of the legislation was that we have a uniform criteria so that a CE instructor who qualifies in one part of the state or one school district would likewise qualify and another, and that we don't have differences depending on their geographical location. So what the legislation does is basically lays out these are the qualifications for a person to be qualified as a CE instructor. Now keep in mind that this really applies only to LEA instructors, so the local K through 12 instructors, because the criteria says if you are an instructor in a UC institution, you're automatically qualified to be a CE instructor. So it really only applies to these LEAs. The policy itself reflects the exact statutory language that was put in place. And so when you see that big block of additional language, that's just the statute. The statute lists what you have to do to be an eligible instructor, that you have to have, for example, your upper level mathematics credential would be one, and that would be for mathematics, or teaches concurrent enrollment course in previous years, or it meets these qualifications that are then listed in the subsequent section of the law, and also would be listed as section 10.4 of the policy. And then that goes through and says, if an instructor meets these following criteria, they are qualified. So it takes that discretion out of the institution's hands to say whether or not they do qualify. But so if they meet those elements, then they are by law qualified. And they hope that that addresses the problem of differences in teachers who would qualify in one area who wouldn't qualify in another geographical area or school district.
So there's transfer issues on instructors too, it sounds like.
Yeah. We actually have seen that. I mean,
I just had to throw it in, sorry.
Yeah. So we're hoping that we can work together with all of the institutions to make sure that we're handling this the right way. There are certain things, for example, if you're going to be a concurrent enrollment teacher in courses other than career and technical education, it requires some things like a master's degree or higher in the concurrent enrollment courses academic field, a master's in any higher academic field, and at least 18 completed credit hours of graduate coursework in the academic field that's relevant to the course, or qualifying experience as determined by the institution of higher education. Now, there's still discretion there to the institutions. They get to determine what that qualifying experience is. So if a teacher doesn't meet the other two qualifications, those two master's degrees, but they say to the school, yeah, but I should be qualifying under your qualifying experience, it's this institution that still gets to determine whether or not that's the case or not. However, the other part of the legislation that is now part of this policy is that we had to set up an appeals process for an LEA to appeal a decision by one of our institutions which determined that an instructor did not qualify to be a CE instructor. So that's what we see here in the policy. We tried to come up with a way that made sense. What we have is that the commissioner, if there is an appeal that comes to the commissioner's office, the commissioner appoints an appeals committee that consists of the Associate Commissioner for Academic Affairs, which this, and then two UC Chief Academic Officers, obviously from one of the institutions that's not at issue. They would review the application, the materials, the standards that the school was using in making that determination, and this policy to determine if the decision was made accurately or not. The only time this is really going to be an issue is if one of those applicants to be a CE instructor has one of those master's degrees or qualifying hours with another master's degree outside of the field, and that the institution has denied on that basis. If the institution is denied on the basis that they don't meet the institution's qualifying experience, there really isn't anything that this appeals committee can do, because under the policy, it's the institution that determines what that qualifying experience is. So, in one way, this appeals process will ensure that there aren't clear errors in determining whether or not this person should have been qualified. It would be whether they have a master's degree in the area that they're teaching, or a master's and have that 18 hours. The one area where this could be an issue for institutions is if under qualifying experience they grant eligibility to one person and then another person who had the same qualifying experience was not granted. And if that's the case, then that's something that this appeals group could also review and make a change. So they have the authority to make the change, but what they actually do is refer or make a recommendation to the commissioner, who then makes the final decision based on that recommendation. There are no appeals after that decision has been made. So the benefit here is we at least get some finality to these questions when they come up. So that's basically the major changes in this policy.
Any questions or comments to R165? Go ahead, Marlon.
Having faith in our legal counsel, I'll move for approval.
That's nice. Any more discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Thanks, Jeff. We're continuing on, and this one is just a change in a mission statement, which I read and thought it was very nice. So I don't know, Jeff, if you want to do it, if you want to.
Yeah, I'll just turn it over. I mean, ultimately,
to the other Jeff.
For those of you who are unfamiliar with R312, that's our policy that governs the institutional missions and roles, as determined by the regents. And one of the portions of that policy includes the mission statement of each institution, which of course they are the author and creator of. And so if there is a change to a mission statement, the policy needs to be updated, and that's what this is. But Jeff, do you want to address the actual mission change that you're putting in here?
So it really is a combination of things. One of them was that we felt like it would be good to have a mission statement. Our current one has a lot of content, and in fact, the proposal, there was some really strong faculty opposition from some faculty members who didn't like our eliminating various phrases that were in the longer statement. But we found no one on campus who could even begin to quote the current one. And so that's really the primary motivator. And then, as part of it, we wanted to really emphasize the dual mission. University and college. And so it comes out and makes that very, very explicit. And then there are other key elements in it that are very important. So everyone is a key word in there. That's our inclusion. That's our inclusive mission. Everyone. And then we educate. Originally we had a different verb there. We changed that. We educate. That's a key part of the mission. So every word is very critical. It was chosen very, very carefully. Extensive process throughout the university and have overwhelming support. All executives approved it unanimously, and an overwhelming majority of faculty approved it as well. So it's broad-based support. It really embodies who we are in a way that you can actually recognize. So that's pretty much it.
Did everybody get a chance to read it?
Have you memorized it?
I have, but whether I can do that in place is very
pressures on other constituents.
I was afraid you would ask.
Sorry.
Is there any comments or a motion to accept this?
We had our R and R at UVU, and the president has it memorized, right?
Oh, I'm shocked.
But they're really excited, and they've taken the next layers below this mission and really supported it, so I'd be happy to make a motion.
Thanks, ma'am. Second? Excellent. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
And I had the opportunity of sitting by Jeff Olson's wife at commencement for dinner. And I think she told me that you're riding off in the sunset with some of the rest of us,
yes,
so.
This is my last Regents meeting, yes.
Yeah, well, I just want you to know how much we appreciate your service, and
you.
We've really enjoyed you on our committee, so thank you so much. They're gonna miss you, so, but thank you so much.
I can say that I'm going to miss you, that UVU is going to miss you as an institution, and you've done a lot for UVU, for its campus, its students, and also for this committee.
Thank you, Richard.
Hey, thanks for going around. But also serving on that campus and watching you come in under President Holland and through that transfer and being intern last summer, it's been really remarkable. He has been the consistency there on campus and added so much, so much. Best wishes and kudos for what you've done.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you. Okay, so now we're going to move on to agenda item number 6, which had some changes come about because of our Access Scholarship. And some of these changes, honestly, have been wanted for longer than I've been around, I'm sure. So when this happened, it was like, this was cheer. I have nothing against other institutions. It's just maybe a little, but not a lot. But anyway, all right, so we're going to talk about the New Century and the Regents Scholarships. A lot of our 604, 609B, 609C, 609A. Okay, Jeff.
All right, so, and luckily we have Carrie here, so if you have any substantive questions, I can pretend like I know, which is generally my fault. So we have 6094 first up, I think, and as Chair Tyer mentioned, this are primarily just a couple of technical fixes and one substantive fix required under the law, because now, after July 1st, students who apply for this program, the only eligible institutions are
Fort
UCHI.
Fort, oh, yeah.
So it takes out the what previously were the private institutions. So that's the major change, and then a couple of technical changes on what's considered a full-time student. It's the same thing with 609B, essentially. We just had to make a couple of technical changes that we wanted to take advantage of while we were opening up these policies. And so you'll see there that there's minor things that we're fixing, some language issues there.
That one also includes the UTEX, then.
Yeah.
609B.
C. 609C. Getting ahead of you, sorry.
Yeah, C. So B, just so it was as confusing as possible, in my wisdom, I decided to keep the same number for all of our Regents programs and delineate them by an additional letter. And so
I'm lost.
A is the program that we were operating under up until this current cohort of students. B is the program that's currently in place that we're operating with, and that includes the supplemental program that was the brainchild that we tried to do what essentially the Promise Scholarship is doing even better. And then C is what the Regents Scholarship will look like moving forward in the world in which we now have the Promise Scholarship.
So will those others go away then after? I guess they're still students.
There's a period of time where they have to be in place.
Because there's still some students
right.
in there.
Five years.
Yep.
They have 5 years from the date of graduation to utilize the scholarship fully. So after 5 years from 2018, then
it can all go
that part would not be applicable. After 5 years from 2019, that would not be applicable. Our 609B would not be applicable.
So the students who applied for the Regents Scholarship, like in January and February, applied under the old, or are they under the new?
So the 2019 high school graduates are under our 609B. the students who apply as a 2020 high school graduate would be under C.
C.
Okay. So when all of those in 5 years and all those things finally rotate, Jeff, you can
take the letters off.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it'll still be 609.
That's why it was a brilliant solution.
It was.
I was just thinking down the road. It's like chess.
Okay, and now it's limited to tuition and fees, right?
For 2020, yes.
Just tuition and fees. And 2020 adds UTech.
USHE and UTech schools will be, students who attend those schools would be eligible for the scholarship.
And so does the funding change for the UTech students, since do they still get the same lump sum, even though tuition's so much different?
Again, because it is limited to their tuition and fees.
It's
after,
only tuition and fees, okay.
After,
sorry, I'm...
Yeah.
That's what we
yeah,
okay.
And it's after other state aid has been considered.
I remember
considered.
That one, it's the last one, so we
And
can't.
So it will be an... The award will be individual for
it'll be a different
everybody.
Amount for every person.
But the board will set
the cap, if you will.
It will exceed
so that we don't
every year.
Yeah,
but
so that
the
we don't exceed.
Has to approve that amount every year, right? Or is that going to change?
It's the worst. They make the appropriation that based
oh, well,
on
we
that
make,
we would
right,
determine.
The
board
yeah,
would
that's
choose.
What I'm saying. But every year the legislature decides.
We do have ongoing dollars, but if additional dollars were to be added, then we would recalculate budget projections and all of that to
but
make sure that...
there is an ongoing amount every year, and sometimes it's... Okay.
So that we don't overspend. We would set a cap, but then the institutions will do an analysis of what other state aid is coming to that student and then award accordingly.
Can you just tell us, since we've kind of made that change to have it go to the institutions, has that worked out? Like,
we haven't done it yet.
It just starts
2019 cohorts. So
it's just going to start this time, so we don't know. Was that just a year ago we did that?
It was the very, very tail end of 2017.
But it didn't deal with until these students. So this is
right.
The first time the institutions are going to have to deal with all that funding stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we have well, in a way, but we have some systems in place that will somewhat have to be mirrored from 2019 to the 2020, in that we do need the institutions to be engaged to do the analysis of how much.
Well, they still have to determine how much each student's getting from all their sources.
Right, and so we're going to for. Leverage processes we have put in place for the 2019 cohort for the 2020 and beyond so that we can not have too many confusing things going on. And we have a meeting at the end of this month that we'll be meeting with the financial aid directors and their staff to, after all of this has passed, to
help.
Go over those things with them again. And so.
Okay. Naina, did you have a comment?
Oh, well, just a little bit on staffing and manpower. I know we've talked about streamlining a few of the scholarships, and then now with these changes and transferring some of that over to the institutions, how do you see that playing out in-house? Does that streamline kind of your office and what you're doing over time? Or?
Well, with changes, it's very difficult to predict how many applicants we will have, and so we need to be mindful that it could go up, could go down, and so we'll be monitoring that closely. And then from there.
The staff generally have been able to review a lot more scholarships than they were in the past because of a lot of the systems that have been put in place. We're not sure if because there's no longer a guaranteed amount, if that's going to really tank the applications this year or not. So we really don't know, but we'll let you know in the fall.
And kudos to your office. I know you have an exceptional team there that works. We appreciate all your work and flexibility on this.
Yes, I agree. They're a great staff. Thank
are.
You.
So a couple of significant changes you'll see in 609C is the removal of the supplemental program completely. So this 609C Region Scholarship version is now back to being strictly a merit-based scholarship, although they still are required to fill out FAFSA.
They still are then?
Yes, it's still there. And then because we now have the system of technical colleges as eligible institutions, we had to make some consideration for how the best way to award a scholarship, because vast differences in the way those are set up versus our schools. And so you'll see in the policy that if you're going to a UC institution, a credit granting institution, this is a 2-year award. Well, what do we say, 4 semesters?
Four total semesters.
4 total semesters. There's some ongoing eligibility requirements that meet, I believe it's 3.0, that they're maintaining that, and that they're still enrolled full-time up to at least 12 hours of credits per semester in order to qualify for that second year. For students who have elected to use their Regents Scholarship at one of our technical colleges, it's a one-time lump sum that's given to them that they can then use.
That kind of goes to their account at the institution?
Yeah, the institution will determine how to spread that out as they complete their credits. But they just have to be enrolled in one of those programs in order to qualify that part.
And can I just add one piece? So, even though we don't have the supplemental component, there is still the review, again, of that need based on their other state aid is a part of it. So that will very much be considered as awarding happens.
That's right. Still a last dollar in program, but eligibility for additional funding will be based on their financial need. That now is a promise.
Okay. Are we all thoroughly confused? Do we have confidence with staff that this all makes sense?
Yeah.
And if one of you would like to present this at the full meeting and explain it, I would be glad to let you do that.
That's
right. I think it will be a crowning achievement.
If not, you're going to kick me off or what? Okay, so.
I know you're looking for motion. I'm not going to give you that. I'm going to ask, I know now that we have Carrie Main, which we're all so excited that she's now on board. You gave me a look. We're just so happy you're here.
I should have introduced her, sorry.
I would be really interested to go forward. I know Spencer's sick of me every year saying, can you send me that list? But if we could, next meeting, the next couple months, get some kind of data on the regents and I know we have breakdowns of where that goes. Do you already have it for us?
So I just received the latest one based off of the 2018 cohort in the raw draft. So we will be refining that and then can provide that to you.
That would be really interesting with that. And as we are changing, you know, where is that going so we can see that? That's really beneficial for us. So.
I think
Thank
it will take 3 years for things to normalize, probably, but it will be interesting to look at how things shift over the next several years.
And one of the things that we're not able to predict with the C cohort is whether they'll skip going to the private institutions and so we'll have extra funding, or whether they'll choose to go to a UC institution or a UTEC where
and
they can use them.
Yeah.
So we have no idea.
Yeah, I actually had quite a long email chain with the mother who was very unhappy about the private institution thing. So we emailed back quite a while. We were friendly. It was friendly. We ended fine. I said, there's 8 great institutions. Pick one, and you can use it. So anyway, it was great. But so anyway, it's happening. Not with you too, Tammy. You had some of that. Yeah. So anyway, I think, you know, I was very honest to tell her it's a Regent scholarship, and I have nothing to do as a Regent. I have absolutely nothing to do with a private thing. So anyway, it's interesting because it'll all happen. It'll all work.
We just need to tell them all to call Representative Owens.
No.
It has allowed for some dialogue with parents that, you know, their student may be a sophomore and they just are 100% certain that they will be going to X institution, and helping them talk through about college choice and making sure that they're aware of the other options. And it's been surprising how many parents don't realize the other options.
It's a very good thing. All right, so I'm looking for a motion for R604, R609B, R609C. The changes that we have been told and we've looked at, so. Thank you, Jaquel. Is there a second? Thanks, Marlon. Any more discussion on this? And we have one more Regent Scholarship one after this. But all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Thank you. All right. R609A.
Okay. So this was a last minute addition. It's only tangentially related to the Regents Scholarship, in fact. And for lack of finding a better solution to this specific problem, this suspicion we may be coming back to this group for another revision of this at some point in the future. But quick background, during this last legislative session, we were appropriated a sum of money of about $75,000 that was to be used for, as the appropriation said, Regents Scholarship Appeals. The legislative intent, as far as we've been able to parse out, was that it's intended for students who had applied for the Regents Scholarship and for whatever reason didn't get the Regents Scholarship, was unsuccessful in getting it through their appeal, and so that it creates sort of a discretionary fund that we can use based on their circumstances to see if we can still give them some sort of scholarship aid, financial aid, through that fund that isn't the Regents Scholarship because they are not qualified. In order for us to be able to disperse the money, we had to have some policy in place that authorized this to happen. And so we tacked it on to the very end of 609A, as you can see. And this is going to be a very limited group of students. These are students or applicants who applied for the scholarship who would have otherwise have been eligible for the scholarship if not for their irreconcilable error in the application process. They had to have exhausted all of their administrative and judicial remedies, which means they'd have to have taken us to court and lost. And then, if they meet all of those, we can look at their individual case and determine if they are going to give them some discretionary funding that they can use for the school. Other than that, this would only be available if we've had an appropriation that's been given to specifically for this very purpose. So other monies can't be used to fill this pot of money. It's only if we have that specific appropriation, which I don't know will happen again. But that's why we put this change in place, and it was a determination we made at the last minute that you haven't seen this before.
You know, I read it. I never thought it when I read that. I never thought they'd have to take you to court and lose, but I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so they'll be out of school by the time they get to this process.
Sorry, I'm going to take the other angle here on this because I, like many, have been approached from some of these folks, and a lot of these folks are in positions where they hear a lot and they represent a lot of folks, and there is a real frustration out there. So I don't know that this is the solution, but I think that this legislation is out of frustration, and we should identify maybe what are the common themes, maybe again some data on where are we falling short on this, because if it is administration or it, you know, there's certain things that I agree, but there are other things that I have experienced through friends and other people where this is real. So I don't know what that looks like, but I think I would request that we see where is the bulk of these folks who are so frustrated when they feel like they've done everything. They might be in a position where resources aren't available, like my high school, where there's one physics class taught one time a day, or Teresa, you had the same thing.
No, my son just chose not to take physics.
But there was...
and then regretted it every semester in college after that.
I don't know what they are. You guys are the experts, you know.
We track what the rationale is in the appeals process.
But if there's a large group there, and there is something in our administration of it that's a problem, I think it's an opportunity for us to look and correct that. So I think it's...
Does the legislation say judicial remedies?
It's not even legislation. It's just an appropriation. So the money comes to us. Right. We've had, through conversations, some direction about what it's to be used for, but there's nothing specific in the actual appropriation that gives us any direction other than it said Regents Scholarship Appeals.
So would you feel better if we took out the judicial word and just said all administrative remedies?
I don't have a problem with this at all. I'm just requesting that we at USU look at what the problems are. Where are the bulk of these complaints coming from? Is it something that we need to correct in the way we administrate?
I get emails from parents. You know, I get them every once in a while, but it's really, there's not a lot. I don't know. Is there a lot of people?
Advised by the Attorney General's office that we have to inform them that they've must follow the judicial route, or we will be stepping into legal hot water. So,
yeah, there's a requirement on every decision that we make from appeal that we explain to them what their next step in the process is, and that's a petition for a judicial review. And that's because this scholarship program, the appeals under it, are governed by the Administrative Procedures Act in Utah, and that's one of the requirements that it has. Your point is exactly right. And I think you hit it on the head, and that is that I know they were seeking a solution. This one is an incredibly difficult one for us to administer. and probably isn't the right direction to go in terms of solving a different problem, but we didn't have a lot of discretion about taking action. So this is the best course that I can think of that didn't open the floodgates to tons and tons of people coming in and seeking funds. And so that's why I made it as restrictive as I did.
So
and if
really
it ends up being too restrictive, we may have to revisit it. We're going to try to feel out. The money is here, and so we had to have something in place to start moving forward with this.
So I appreciate this. That's not at all my comment. And my comment is that I think out of all these groups that are appealed or being denied, which we know, we see that data in your report, but what are the common themes? Why? You know, are 8%?
She could probably, tell you. She
okay.
doesn't.
Yeah. Well, I just
and I also will say that what we do with our process is throughout the year. So in 2016, we completely revamped our administrative system, which allowed us greater flexibility to administrate and communicate with students in a different way than what we were able to do before. And so I would say appeal situations that were prior to 2016 are different, are somewhat different than currently, but each year we take an opportunity to look at common themes that came up and how do we alter our application process, any verbiage and that sort of thing, so we evaluate that annually. But the biggest thing that happens is that students don't follow through. When they get a message saying we need you to submit this, they don't submit, and that's one of the biggest things. And so we will send reminders. In fact, next week a reminder goes out. We will have 3 reminders sent in the next 6 weeks, and students won't respond. That's one of the big things.
Anticipating that he's going to see this policy again. This solution provides a remedy to exactly nobody, right? there is nobody that has ever gone through the whole process of suing, and then they're going to come back. I'm puzzled. Under the administrative remedies legislation, I thought you go through the administrative remedies that are available, and then your court of forum of last resort, judicial, and the judge finally makes a final decision. How does after that come back to us for some further?
That's why, you're exactly right. That's how it works, and the judge's decision is the final decision, I guess, if you want to appeal.
So why can't we just shrug our shoulders and say,
we have done that. It hasn't alleviated the frustration that specific legislators have from their constituents. That's why, although it's tacked on to this particular policy, it's not Regents Scholarship, because there's been a final decision on their eligibility for the Regents Scholarship. So this money was intended for people who didn't qualify, even though they exhausted their administrative remedies, they still didn't qualify. But looking at their file, it was because of that error that they had that they didn't qualify, but they otherwise would have. We have the ability to at least give them something from a different
pot of money. You're giving them money, but it'll never be told that it's the Regents
Scholarship.
It's not
the Regents Scholarship. They're done with that. This is a discretionary fund. Yeah, this is exactly my reaction to the face that you just made.
But so if they...
You didn't mean to make a face, it was involuntary.
So
you're saying this is actually going to help you do your job. That's
it. It'll probably make it harder.
A policy that has such limited hypothetical value.
Yeah. Well, and the problem is it's either restricted the way it is, or if we remove, for example, the judicial remedy, we've gone from just a couple of maybe 3 or 4 people over the years to hundreds and hundreds who now would be seeking redress through this discretionary fund. It's just it's a very inelegant solution to the problem, probably completely the wrong solution, but fortunately it's been appropriate to us, and their expectations that we're going to use the money for that purpose.
I don't support this policy, but I do support you.
So if a judge ruled in favor of the student, then they would be awarded the Regents Scholarship.
Yes.
Correct.
So
if the judge said no,
then they could get some of that 75 grand.
Seems like our response to them should be, go tell it to the judge.
We have said that.
Well, I think what they're saying, if you went to all that work and all that money to have a lawyer and do all this, we're going to throw you a few thousand bucks from this fund of $75,000. Isn't it kind of like?
It's hush money.
Yeah.
We're done.
I move passage.
Oh, thank you. Is there a second? Oh, no. Thanks.
I want to go through this discussion.
All in favor, say aye. Did you say hi, Marlon? Hi. Okay, motion passes. Well, that was exciting. All right. There is a chance that this might be the last time that we see number 8, revision of policy R805, for 20 years on our agenda, so we can help that. For those who in the room haven't been here before, we have gone over this for lots and lots of months. And you know what, though? I was actually thinking of this when I was reading the latest thing we got from Jeff a week or so ago. And I just thought, I mean, I finally read it and felt good. And so it's really okay with me that we did that. And I'm embarrassed that I didn't welcome Carrie Main to our thing. But she actually, her position is actually a part of this bill now. I mean, this policy now. So that's right. We're happy to have you here, though. So anyway, we've talked about this a lot. I don't know if you want to make any comments, Jeff, about your latest whatevers. Or
I can just give a brief overview of how this has changed from the last one that came before this committee. So the approach is different in that what we're doing now is rather than having a data report and analysis brought to the board directly, that the schools partner with Carrie or whoever is filling Carrie's spot, should have forbid she had gone somewhere. We should put her name in the policy. that the school work with Carrie to assess and analyze their workforce demographic data for their institution. And then based on those elements that we had in the previous policy, so we're looking at gender, race, ethnicity, we're looking at that delineated down based on pay and this is for faculty and also for staff. And then the burden is on the president to take that data and to identify strategies that will address areas where they feel like they could be doing better with their demographic representation and meeting the goal that you are setting in this policy. And that's to ensure that the UC institutions are employing a diverse, representative, and equitably compensated workforce across all levels, and also provide students with that educational experience where they're exposed different perspectives, experiences, and backgrounds. So you're setting the goal, and then you're giving the burden to the institutions to get the data to see if they're meeting that goal and if not, to identify the strategies. The connection back to the board is that as part of their R208 review, which is their resource review team that they do annually, one of the things they would now, under this policy, be required to address is what they have found and how they're addressing it. And then that goes into the report when they come back from their evaluation.
That would be a yearly
update
to the
in the spring when it's ours.
Well,
we talked about that. Remember then we said
because we set the agenda in spring.
Spring is when they do the evaluation. Mm-hmm. Fall is when you do more of an informal discussion.
Yeah.
So spring is the.
And our written report then
will
be included. Yeah.
Yeah. That's all. Yep.
Yeah, and I appreciate Jeff's patience with some of us through all this. He did show an extreme amount of patience. He would work and then he would receive something that had everything crossed out. So.
I remember that. You can actually see that we did jettison the red line and just went with an entirely new policy. So this was a lot clearer.
It would have been really confusing, actually,
to
see.
So I thought that we were just replacing the whole thing.
Well, there are a lot of eyes across the state on this, and there would be a lot of people happy that.
Yes.
Implementation plan.
So
thank you.
Yeah. So I'm guessing that Nina probably wants to make the motion to approve.
I would love
this.
To make that motion that we approve R805.
Second.
Surprise. All right. Any comments? A few regions at the end that are a different gender than the rest of us. Are you okay with all this?
My minorities.
Well, you are protected because it used to say women and something, and now it says gender, so you are protected. So, okay, are we good?
This is a very difficult policy because I think the passage, we live in a time where we're declaring safe spaces, white rights interfered with, is, you know, we're trying to dislodge somebody or remember somebody. So I hope that, that we as a system have enough patience to let this roll out over time so that we're actually, to our actions, protecting everybody, everybody's rights and being appropriate in these transitions. It'd be very interesting to see how it plays out.
You know, and it was interesting this morning as we listened to President Carlston, and he talked about his cabinet and the changes he made, and he was very clear on telling us that while the makeup of the has changed in his cabinet, that people weren't chosen on gender, they were chosen on ability. But anyway, and I appreciated that, and hopefully that's it. And I know I talked to a Salt Lake Tribune reporter yesterday about this, so it'll be interesting to see how dumb I sound tomorrow. But but I think my point was is that I just think we want to see trends. We just want to see trend. I mean, it's just trend. And as long, and I agree with you that this isn't going to, you know, we don't expect the line to go like this. I mean, you just want to see a trend that we do this. So it is going to be interesting. Go.
Well, and not only, I mean, we all know, I've mentioned it many times, of I pulled data like this myself for institutions and had an institution go, okay, like, let's start looking at what this data looks like, what is our trend, and what decisions can we make? Don't know what the data is saying, and you don't know what changes you need to make or what direction you should be going. And so each institution, that's incredibly important. But even listen to President Watkins today, I was in a more private conversation with her about, they are working with campus safety. They hired a female investigator in their police force specifically to help, because they were noticing in a trend that with all of their detectives being male, that with issues with students were arising that could be fixed by helping employ other types of diverse individuals. And so even in that case, if you're not asking those questions going, hey, we have a problem, how do we solve it? We're not looking at that. And so I'd commend institutions and this policy to help us system-wide be able to navigate that and be able to make smarter choices.
Thanks. Go ahead, Joe.
You, the approach that we're taking really is to increase fairness. It isn't, you know, it really is to increase fairness. So we've started to implement pilots and other things, more careful search processes, which are not, where we try to expand the pool, not by focusing in on the characteristic of somebody, but carefully reviewing the criteria to be sure we aren't just using traditional measures without really thinking through, is this what we actually really need? Because we found that when we use traditional measures, we end up excluding people who are doesn't need to be that particular time. Maybe there is something else that really is equivalent. So anyhow, we're trying to actually increase fairness in this process, and the results I think are being good. So.
And I know some of us met with Linda and talked to her a little bit, and it's amazing what you can figure out stuff by just looking at the data, you know, just looking at to see what's there and then deciding. So. I know you're making great strides.
Why is this the way that it is? And sometimes
yeah.
you find that something you need to adjust, and sometimes you find that
it's not.
Your reading is a legitimate
yeah.
basis for the
yeah.
difference.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add that that's such a great testimony of what that school's done, and what we are hoping this policy will do is help institutions refocus those lens and capitalize on the human capacity that's out there that we just need to look at differently. So kudos on that. And then I was just going to add that the position segregation or occupational segregation, those biases that keep us from recognizing that capital that's right in front of us. So I think this is going to be really valuable as we reflect the data and use it in that way. But for me, my personal motivation on this was really a year ago when we sat with those Dixie students on that campus, those of you who were in that room, and just had this powerful experience with these students. We hear the presidents champion the growth of our diverse student profiles, but yet they want to see that reflected in those who instruct and lead and run the campus. And so I hope this does this for our students so they can feel this safety on their campus, as well as combined with all the other reasons why we're doing this. So,
thank you. Go ahead.
Just one quick follow. I want to thank Regent Tyer and others who were involved for working this through. You know, the courts have indicated a willingness to let us correct, to do what we're talking about, let us correct problems. And the way this has written allows us to look at the data internally and correct things before they get published to the world and we invite lawsuits. So I'm grateful for that.
I thought we had a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
We did. Aye.
Aye. Good? Okay. Thank you so much. That is a great one. I'm so glad. Are you glad you don't have to do it anymore?
I feel like a new person.
Oh, you're fine.
Well, it did come out really well.
Yeah, it came. I think it's better than it was, and I think that's the whole point. I think it's better, so that's a good thing. All right, so now we...
I guess part of my point is this. There is such a ubiquitous agreement around this theme of diversity. The university is already,
they're doing it. Everybody's doing it in this direction.
My only concern about this policy, I guess, is that it might apply unholy pressures on folks to do more than what Jeff has described. You know, that there might be some urgency of timetable and so forth that causes some unholy results that are not anticipated, but they could be driven by new pressure. We already have so much momentum moving in this positive direction.
Right. Well, I agree with you totally. And I think, too, we have to remember the size of our institutions. Because if Snow College makes some change, that's going to really adjust their line. You know what I'm saying? But if University of Utah
right.
makes a change, it doesn't, you know what I'm saying? So I think that's why I think it's so good that it's in with the R&R team. And so each institution is going to be looking at itself. Here, this, you know, when it first came out, it was kind of like, oh, we're going to have this graph that, you know, shows everybody against each other. And that's not going to be it now. It's each institution looking at itself because they are all different. So anyway, we'll see what happens, right?
Okay. Nobody's going to run the room thinking
Well, we might.
We're
going to continue this policy in Houston,
though. We'll look at our policy.
We're giving Jeff anxiety, thinking that we're going to make a motion to like add something to it. He's like constantly stressed over it.
I do have a good paragraph in mind, Jeff.
Oh,
there's
wait.
Lawyers.
Try to reassure us that we're not.
We just did this. Did the one we look at had Marlon suggest? You didn't add Marlon.
It's like an improvement grammatically, you can just make that change.
Because we didn't, because Marlon had a suggestion for a word, and when I read it, it made sense to me too, Marlon. It was in.
Teresa?
What? No.
It was already published when Marlon made the suggestion.
I know.
So we can do that without action.
Since it doesn't substantively change it, I'll just make
no,
that
I
change.
I had it in my notes to remember that, and I didn't.
I remember.
Okay. Okay.
So I, yeah, that change will be reflected in the ordinance.
No, it's just adding one word in 3.2 before.
Right.
Something. Yeah. Anyway. All right. Ooh. Okay. No, it wasn't a big deal. Okay. So now we have the Technology Initiative Advisory Board funding allocations that we see every year. And Blair, you're going to take this on?
Yes, thank you. So John Sutherland, who is chair of the Technology Initiative Advisory Board, normally makes this presentation. He had a longstanding out-of-town commitment and is unable to be here today, so I've been asked to present this particular item. This past legislative session, we were appropriated $5 million to infuse into the engineering and computer technology initiative. And so in accordance with statute, TIAB reviewed proposals from institutions and has recommended a distribution of funds which the Board of Regents then may approve. The proposals that the board received exceeded $7.4 million, so a little over $2.4 million over the $5 million available. And so as the TIAB reviewed those proposals, they followed statutory language. They gave consideration to items such as hiring and retaining faculty, equipment purchases, and funding for new engineering and computer technology programs. They also looked at additional graduates that have been contributed by institutions in targeted programs, and this, of course, was a significant factor in their recommendations. So with that, on page 3 of the memo that you have in front of you, it shows the allocations that the TIAB is recommending, and we present these to you as the, you know, the commissioner and the staff also recommending approval for this particular allocation.
Do we have any comments about that? I know I really appreciate these advisory board members. Some of them have been around a long time, and they do this every year, and it's not easy to not give institutions as much money as they want. So I appreciate their careful consideration of these. Is there any questions for Blair about this money? Do this every year, kind of like a, if not,
just
what?
What curiosity question. When was this based on proposals that the university submitted and then prioritized on that?
Yes. Each, so after the appropriation was made by the legislature, John Sutherland contacted each of the engineering deans at each of our institutions and asked for proposals. And so these numbers, the requests from institutions that you see, that's the total value of dollars that they had requested for support from this $5 million. And then, of course, the other colonies. The TIAB looked at their proposals, weighted against statutory language what they could propose, and then came up with this allocation.
I was just curious because snow is getting 30, and
yeah.
They were, this morning, President Carlson was talking about some other initiatives that they are putting in place, so it was just a curiosity for SUU and for...
Right, so there's three that have, you know, as you notice, have relatively minor amounts of allocation being recommended. Much of that was the board's review of the contributions towards additional graduates into these targeted areas.
Makes sense.
They didn't want to just not fund any institution. They wanted everybody to have a piece of this, but the weightier ones went to some other institutions. And Chair Tyer is correct. These are very agonizing
yes.
conversations. It's a
I was
very
just
difficult,
looking at that.
It's a very difficult thing to do.
Making a decision like that takes a lot of...
I think they've been, a lot of them have been around long enough. They make real careful consideration, I believe. I feel very confident about it. Would somebody like to make a motion to approve these amounts? We need to do that.
Second.
I move. Sorry, I move.
All in favor? Aye.
I made all so many motions.
Motion passes. With so much excitement and thrill, I'm just really happy.
It's just money stuff.
All right, so everybody check your phones.
Wrong
we made
committee.
It. We
yeah,
made it through
right.
All
I'm
of
excited.
Our action items before we're supposed to go. So now we just have an information item that Liz says won't take her more than 35 minutes. So we'll turn the time over to Liz for the.
She asked me how long would it take, and I thought she was asking me how long we had in the committee. I said, oh, 15 minutes. She said, 15 minutes? Take me about two. I just wanted to keep you apprised of where we are on implementing the UCHE Women's Leadership Exchange Program. It has really been a lot of fun for me. You may recall that in November you heard from Nancy Houck, who is at Dixie State, and Jesse Hill, who has been working with UV Self at UVU, and they had this idea for expanding something that they had tried, which was a mentorship exchange program between their two campuses and themselves, and using UV Self in that way. And these are gung-ho people, and we have gone through a really pretty rigorous process for nominating individuals to this program and having their institutions support them. And then we were able to select 21 people into the program, which will begin in August with the very first meeting. And our hope is that some regents will also be able to be there on that day. I think it's August 9th. In order to see the mentor and protege exchange, we're kind of going to do a little bit like a speed dating thing. So we'll have mentors and proteges there together and see if they can find a match for the kinds of projects they have interest in. And then they'll launch into their project and do their exchange with their mentor. So we are cooking along on that. It's taken a fair number of hours, but we've got a wonderful cadre of people to start off. So we'll hope that it is very successful. It won't be for lack of enthusiasm that we don't do well in this. We've got a lot of very enthusiastic participants.
Thanks for your effort with that.
Sure.
Appreciate that.
Are regents being mentors as well? Are they being asked, or how does that?
You know, I don't know that the idea is that it would be somebody who's actually in an administrative position on a campus, but I don't know why, if a person is really interested in the system level operation, it couldn't be a regent. I mean, if that's what their project is about.
I can't remember.
Yeah. Well, it's been a little bit fuzzy because I think it would be really valuable for some of these people to have that kind of interaction. But they're also, the large majority of them are thinking about advancing their career. And so somehow maybe there's a combination we could do there that would allow them to do. Yeah, you know, kind of look on at the region and system operation, which is one of the things that I think will be a real plus with this. Many of the campuses do professional development programs for their faculty and staff, but it's very insular. You know, it's learning more about the campus and how that works and so on. And these people are really interested in that, but also in sort of seeing the system, seeing another institution, kind of broadening their perspectives, and interaction with the region would really help in that regard. So we'll chat about it a little more, and if you have a real interest, we'll see. We'll hope during that August meeting we can do some kind of match-up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else? If not, we get lunch.
I would just like us all to appreciate our wonderful chair. Teresa, you have done an amazing job with this committee, and I have only been able to say it for the past year, but you have made such an impact in education in the entire system and in K-12 in the entire state. And so seriously, thank you so much. Thank you for running this committee and for all of your hard work on all the many initiatives. Thank you.
Great experience.
Great experience.
Great.
to mention that lunch is in the library.
So we're going back to where we started.
On the second floor.
They say that's a warmer building. They turned off the boiler.
It's cold.
I
made you.
It always happens. You have the coat on too.
I know.
Well, they have.
She did offer a blanket from his car.
We wear jackets.
Where the legal family is not seen as really tried in Robert's rule.
We're assured it's been totally sanitized.
A lot to wear here.
Hey, Cheryl.